often when we do see changes in disease between in the microbiome, and we think that the changes in the microbiome are the cause of the disease, but I think often it's just the inflammation that is causing the change, and there are only certain microbes that can sense it and can adapt to the changes, because also inflammation, you have a lot of antimicrobials being produced, all these immune cells are becoming active, so it's a very antimicrobial environment, and that of course will also have a big impact. And it's, I think, something we often ignore in the field.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. Thanks for joining us for this special year-end episode, looking back at 2025. You will hear a conversation with three guests from our board of directors who share their perspectives on the scientific advances of the year that were especially noteworthy in the biotics and microbiome fields. We hope you enjoy exploring these highlights and come away with inspiration to continue advancing the science in 2026.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill, and this is the ISAP Science, Microbes and Health podcast. And on today's episode, I'm the only host because we have three guests. And our three guests are Maria Marco, who's the current president of ISAP, Sarah Labir, who's the incoming president or the next president of ISAP, and Gabriel Vinderola, who's a very active board member with ISAP. But I've said ISAP now about six times already, Maria. Can you tell me what ISAP is exactly for any listeners who don't know?
Hi, Colin. Great to be here. So ISAP stands for International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, and really all the biotics now, Colin. And we're in ISAP. It's a nonprofit, science-facing organization dedicated to advancing and recognizing excellence in the biotics field. And that brings us to areas of scientific leadership and guiding and giving support or recognition and even criticism, importantly, in the field, building communities and growing knowledge beyond academics or industry to the public broadly.
And it's, as you said, it's a nonprofit, and the individuals on the board, you know, they're not remunerated for their role. So I want to ask all three of you, but I'll start with you, Maria, and the other two can start thinking about their answer. What does ISAP mean to you? Why are you involved?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I started in the field in the early 2000s, ISAP was just the place to be. And I've, as an academic myself, professor at University of California, Davis, and now, but back then I was a postdoc and just finding my way as a newcomer. And I've always felt that ISAP is just leading in the a thought leading group in the field. So that's what I think is really special about ISAP and why how I think of it.
Gabrielle, can I ask you the same question? What does ISAP mean to you, and why are you involved?
Sure. I've been in the probiotic field from the year 95. So since the very beginning, since ISAP appeared, it has been a guiding light for us in South America. We don't have nothing like that. And suddenly I was invited to join the board. So I say, oh my God, this is like not even a dream came true, because I never thought that would be part of ISAP. So if I can provide some insight, some perspective from Latin America, for me, it's the most important thing that happened in my career. So being close to all that knowledge, all your surname has been always a reference for us. Okay, maybe if we can say something from South America, from Argentina, for me, it's great. So it's really important for me, and it has impacted my career in ways that I never imagined before.
Sarah, for you, the same question?
Yeah, a bit a similar story. So I started my PhD in 2004 when the probiotic definition was just out. I think it was based on a WHO consensus panel. But then later I learned that ISAP was working more on a new definition, and that all experts were gathering together to advance the field. So it was really, for me as a PhD student, already like a guiding scientific group that I had to follow. And I was super honored, the same as Gabriel, that I was invited to join the board from a very small country in Europe, Belgium. We don't have that many microbiome and probiotic researchers in our country. So it also, the networking opportunity is super relevant for us. The positive and inspiring atmosphere. I think it's a very, in a way, a very difficult field to work in, but it's super nice to see that so many academics across the world actually have the same vision and ambition and want to collaborate and move the field all together. I think for me, that's the most important aspect of ISAP, that we have a joint mission.
Okay, thanks to all three of you for that. And there is a podcast way back in the series with the founders of ISAP talking about how ISAP originated. So if anyone's really interested, I encourage you to go back and listen to that one maybe. But one of the big highlights, I mean, one of the big standout things that ISAP does every year is organize an annual meeting. And this year's meeting was in Banff in Canada, very well attended. I could explain that there's about 50 industry members. Isn't that right, Maria? Around that number anyway? And they get to send two members to the conference, and then the board invites academic experts and, of course, the board's members themselves and organize the scientific meeting. You can't attend if you're not invited, and that's what makes ISAP feel kind of exclusive, and a lot of people are very happy to be part of it once they get into the family, if you like. But it was an absolutely fantastic meeting in Canada this year. And what I'd like you please to do is your own highlight from the meeting. Gabriel, maybe we'll start with you. What was your highlight from this year's annual meeting?
Okay. Yes, I think that ISAP does many, many things along the year, but every month we are thinking in the annual meeting. So there is no way that it's not a good meeting. So every year you are back from the meeting with a lot of insight and thoughts. But for me this year, there was a panel about clinical translation of biotic science that I think is very, very relevant, because you may have many, many research on biotics, but how does impact people? What of everything that is translated to real day-to-day life? And the panel was opened by Howard Bouchner. He's a professor of pediatrics, and he was the editor of journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA. And he gave like an insight about what is the scientific combination ecosystem, with very, very impressive data. For example, he said that every year 3 million papers are published, but only around 100 can change practice. So that's a huge filter. So very, very few amount of paper at the end will change practices. And what changes practices at the end will be the guidelines from professional societies. So I think ISAP has some relevance there, because ISAP is involved in, for example, Hania Zajewska, she participates in the guidelines for probiotics from EBSCAN. So at the end, ISAP is impacting that. He also discussed some recent controversial topics, for example, immunization. Vaccines here in Argentina, suddenly people start mistrusting vaccines. So I think we have a lot of to communicate in this sense. But always he gave some very nice advices to researchers, to investigators. For example, he noted the increasing use of very hype words like novel, innovative, transformative, crucial. So he said, okay, please be a little bit more modest when you apply for a grant, when you publish a paper. Please choose the word carefully. Causality can be shown only with randomized controlled trials. He said that we should be very cautious when we have a press release from our university, because our university, they tend, you know, to over-announce things because they are very proud that the research is from there. So we have to be very, very attentive to that. And he also pointed that we have been losing the number needed to treat in most randomized clinical trial, that sometimes you need a number needed to treat of 50 and nobody speak about, and that is not very impactful in real life. So I think I do a lot of science communication, and sometimes you are very enthusiastic with biotics, with fermented foods. And I think that's a great lesson that we had, that, okay, we have to be a little bit more modest, very close to the data, take a look to the primary outcomes. And something that is maybe is directed to us, he mentioned podcasts. Podcast, nobody supervised podcast. It's not like a publication. So in podcast, people can say anything. So I think we, as hosts, I've been hosting with Eamon Keighley, have to be very, very alert, that not to overstating, and be very close to data. And I think that was an amazing opening for the panel.
And how did he suggest that people would address that? I mean, you publish a paper, you're very proud of it, or you're writing a grant, or you just got a grant. And of course, the communications department of your university has a very different mission to yours. Theirs is to get clicks and get into the local newspaper and maybe on the local radio or TV. And so they feel like, you know, scientists are too reticent and they won't say enough, and they kind of maybe take the story and blow it up a little bit. How did Howard think you can deal with that? I mean, you don't want to always be dampening down your own research. And
exactly. Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with the own responsibility. I'm researching, I have to be very responsible, but also responsibility is something that you are trained. I think we as researchers must get some training in communication, because at the end, it's your own responsibility to say things in the way that is very, very close to data.
Yeah, it always worries me, though, that I don't want to pick any particular scientific controversy right now, but the anti-science person can say virtually what they want, while the pro-science person has to be very reasoned and on the one hand and on the other hand. And if you're listening to it as a listener, you're going to think, I'm convinced by the anti-science person. They seem passionate and committed, and they're telling me things that are fact. And the scientist is doing the, oh, well, maybe, but not, I'm not sure. And maybe we need some more, you know, every scientist finishes with, we need more research, which is not a very satisfying thing for the listener to hear. How do we address that?
I think that will be more and more difficult, because yesterday I was giving a talk for a radio, local radio. And in the past, people would get the knowledge from a conference, from a TV show where a medical doctor was invited. But now with social media, anybody can talk. I think it will be more and more difficult. Maybe we have to do something like they are doing in China, that they will ask people in social media to have some training if you are going to talk about health. But I'm not sure how we will manage that with social media, people getting information only from social media. Really, to be honest, I don't know how we will deal with that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic right across science, not just in our area, of course. Sarah, what was your highlight from the annual meeting?
Oh, there was, of course, many highlights. I remember the section on healthy aging and the microbiome. For me, that's, I think in various meetings last year, the topic on healthy aging was popping up. And it's a super complex topic, yeah, because it's not one disease. And how do you define healthy aging? But there seem to be a lot of associations. For example, I love the metabolomics talk by Elaine Holmes. But I think for me, the new research I was already aware from publications, but it was for me a super fascinating talk was from Carolina Troppini. She is, I think, an assistant professor now in Canada, but she has done a postdoc, I think, in Stanford or in the US. But she's by training a biophysics or physics expert. And she I remember one of the phrasings she was using in her talk was that, so she focused on a more ecological and engineering point of view on the microbiome. And I think she, for example, compared aspects such as fever or cancer or inflammation as really causing microclimate shifts for the microbes, a bit like climate change for us as humans. These are major physical events that have a big impact on the microbiome and that we actually totally ignore, or most of us ignore in the fields. And then I was also inspired. So I'm also by training a bioscience engineer, and we spent a lot of time in our lab to engineer lactobacilli and trying to genetically modify. She goes even a step further and is doing a lot of cool in situ engineering with bacteroides, so at, I think different gut microbes, and then they adapt them or they make them, transform them into biosensors so that they can inside the gut sense or detect pH changes or osmolarity changes, temperature changes, oxidative stress changes, and then they put all the data in a model and also try to control and engineer that. And I think it's a really nice combination of synthetic biology, ecology, with also clinical relevance. So I loved that talk.
Yeah, I must admit, I really like that talk by Carolina as well. And, you know, I guess we want to be a little bit clear with the audience, if they're not totally au fait with what's going on in probiotic science. This was not for therapeutic purposes. I mean, she wasn't bioengineering Nope. strains and making genetically modified organisms to administer to people. They were to report on the conditions within the gut.
No, it's definitely important to say it is more for, especially mainly for mouse models, although they are also trying to use it for mechanistic research. But it's important to have more fundamental insights on how the gut microbiome functions, and then later, hopefully, some of these insights can be used to design better next generation probiotics. And I think it can also be relevant for even the classic probiotics, classic Lactobacilli bifidobacteria. We also don't understand why one strain is now a better performer than the other, why one strain is better in inflammatory conditions and the other is better for maybe to prevent infections. And I think also this mechanistic research will help us in the future.
And I love the idea of the microclimate of the gut. Is the concept here that, say, an inflamed gut is almost like a global warming scenario that different bacteria will respond and change and react to that? Because sometimes we think of bacteria as just being kind of blind little single-celled organism, but they're very sensitive to change, aren't they? I mean, they can really detect their environments and process that information in a very sophisticated way.
That's at least how I interpret it, but and it's also how I see it. And I think it's super important to realize that, because often when we do see changes in disease between in the microbiome, and we think that the changes in the microbiome are the cause of the disease, but I think often it's just the inflammation that is causing the change, and there are only certain microbes that can sense it and can adapt to the changes. Because also inflammation, you have a lot of antimicrobials being produced, all these immune cells that are becoming active, so it's a very antimicrobial environment, and that of course will also have a big impact. And it's, I think, something we often ignore in the field.
Yeah, it is a very noisy environment in the gut, I'm sure. And I'll go back to my own favorite thing. More research needs to be done, I think. Happily, there's people like Carolina doing that kind of research. Maria, what's your highlight from the annual meeting?
Oh, it is hard to choose. One of the highlights always is just the community. And I think that was already raised earlier, and just the opportunity to talk and have real conversations is certainly a highlight. But if I were to pick one thing that really struck me from this meeting is just microbial metabolites. And we saw that in a few of the talks, and then Gabriel and I led a discussion group. It's another highlight of these meetings, but these discussion groups on microbial metabolites. And so in the plenary sessions, we had a really exciting talk by an early career investigator, Bijan Tian, from Jinan University, who really elegantly described how this particular microbial metabolite called Indole-3 lactic acid, or Indole-3 lactate, which is a derivative of tryptophan metabolism, can signal to the brain to relieve depression. So through the gut-brain axis. And this particular metabolite and this group of metabolites from tryptophan has really broadened from our study of the gut microbiome to be really important, not just in signaling to the brain, but also to the immune system as well. And so I think this is an exciting time of convergence between probiotics and the gut microbiome, because a lot of what we understand about these tryptophan metabolites come from the study of the resident microbes in our intestine. But probiotics, and in particular, Pijan was describing how probiotics make these compounds as well, and in particular bifidobacteria, that can also make them and be able to restore the willingness to live. So removing depression or alleviating that. And of course, this isn't a mouse study, but I think we're going to be seeing relationships grow between what we're finding mechanistically in animal studies and what we're finding in people. To single out another metabolite briefly is vinegar, acetate in vinegar. And we had a really nice talk by Kate Al from Western University in Canada, who was describing a pilot study with acetate capsules, and also looking at people's responses in alleviating stress and improving mood. So it's not just going to be one metabolite that's important, but many. And I think it's just an exciting field, and to see how it's growing.
Extraordinary area. And I mean, eventually we're going to have to get to that point of looking at individual molecules, because all of life, all of behavior, all of everything is molecules interacting with molecules. That's what it is. That's what all nature is. And, you know, we get beyond the descriptions and the associations that, Sarah mentioned to actual metabolites impacting actual, you know, ligands binding to things and causing downstream effects. Problem, of course, with probiotics and prebiotics is probably polypharmacy. There's so many molecules interacting with so many receptors at any given stage. It's hard to pull that apart. Gabrielle, you were going to comment on that?
Yes, I want to very quickly bring the highlight that I saw in the discussion group that Maria Markowitz, giver share from Agriscope from Switzerland. He brought into discussion a concept that I found amazing, the concept of the extended microbiome, metabolome. He said that the metabolome of a fermented food may resemble the gut metabolome. And he fermented, I don't remember which substrate, with 24 strains of lactic acid bacteria. And the metabolome he got was 80% similar to the human metabolome. So we were thinking maybe if our diet is poor in fiber, can we compensate with fermented food the metabolites we don't get by fermented fiber? So I found that concept amazing. And there is a lot of to research there in the fermented food metabolome.
Yeah, it was very clever work. And Maria, I'm going to put you on the spot, I'm afraid, because you're the president. So we said earlier there would be 50 member companies at these meetings, and that could mean 100 industry people at the meeting. And we have discussions, and out of those discussions come sometimes consensus papers, position papers, quite influential papers. How does ISAP protect against being just a kind of a stooge of the industry, that the industry pushes its views through this kind of facade of academic scientists? And how does ISAP protect itself against that and still maintain an independent voice?
Yeah, that's a really important question, Colin. And I think we navigate it by keeping an arm's length with the industry. And but importantly, what I want to add there, that the folks from industry who are at the ISAP meetings, they are scientists. They're typically, or they're clinicians or PhD scientists. And so they really are invested in developing like solid science understanding in the field to a large degree. But because we are an all-volunteer academic board that's running, driving the mission of ISAP, we come at it from that arm's length distance with industry. So in our activities, for example, the consensus panels, we do make that an academic or clinical initiative, and then we follow up with discussion with industry. And building, for example, resources to share by them or by clinicians. And so that sort of interactive, sort of symbiotic environment, I would say. But for sure, we try to avoid these conflicts of interests that would be very problematic as we try to move forward in the field.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more that the industry scientists are obviously just as intelligent and clever and as well qualified and do the same kind of research that the academics do. They just work for companies rather than universities. But you're right. I mean, keeping that arm's length and making sure that everything has that distance from the industry partners when we're issuing perspectives and position papers and things like that, that's really important. But can I broaden it out then beyond the annual meeting? Biotics is a very dynamic area, and there's work going on, of course, that it wasn't covered by the ISAP annual meeting. Sarah, maybe I'll start with you. What were some of the scientific or what aspect of biotic science had you found most fascinating this year outside of the ISAP meeting?
Yeah, outside the ISAP meeting, but actually also a link with ISAP is that, and I just picked it random because it was a topic during our lunch breaks in our research group, was the super exciting work, I think, from one of our board members, Jens Walter, who is developing a specific diet. I think it's named the NIME diet or the non-industrialized microbiome restored diet. And we have seen it popping up on social media after, I think also this year, it was a Cell paper where they did an intervention study with this non-industrialized diet. I think it would contain, for example, beans and sweet potatoes and rice and cucumber. And it was actually inspired by a group in Papua New Guinea, which was living in a non-industrialized way and had a very healthy gut microbiome. And actually, apparently, they not only published a Cell paper this year, but they also managed to bring it to the public and consumers. And they have now this custom-made packages that people can buy and then eat at home to restore their gut microbiome and also have some cardiovascular or metabolic effects. And it's inspiring because we were just discussing as academics, we'd like to stay in our silo and just only focus on the science. And it's very inspirational that they at least try to bring it to consumers.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Jens is actually my kind of, we share a wall here, his office and my office share a wall. So I'm very familiar with Jens's work. I think they pronounce it Naimi diet. I think at least how I've heard Jens pronounce it. And I think we have two podcasts on that topic, one with Arnissa and one with Jens. So again, if people are interested, they can go back and hear it. But you're right. I mean, he's really translating. You can now in Ireland, you can order these Naimi diet food parcels from a company that makes them, get them delivered to your home and eat a non-industrialized Papua New Guinean diet. It's a fantastic bit of translational science. Maria, what was your highlight outside of the ISAP meeting?
Well, I want to highlight a paper that was published about a year ago from the laboratory of Will Luddington, who was at the Carnegie Institution and now at Johns Hopkins University, and his postdoc, Karina Gutierrez-Garcia, who's now starting a faculty position, I believe it in Arizona. And this paper I found back early 2025, but it was presented at the Gordon Research Conference on Lactic Acid Bacteria this summer and here in California. Okay, what was this paper about? It was about the identification of a host colonization factor in Lactobacillus plantarum, one of my favorite microbes. And this paper was in Science, and you know, every now and then an important paper comes along that can really help define the future of the field. And some really elegant experiments done in their model, Drosophila, showed how passage of plantarum and culture medium, this wild plantarum strain, lost the capacity to really colonize Drosophila. And it didn't take many generations, which is kind of scary to me, like how fast these host adaptation factors can be lost. But then they went further to show it was a specific locus that was mutated in these isolates that can no longer colonize the gut. And it turns out this locus is encoding an adhesins that these particular serine reach repeat proteins that allow plantarum to colonize in Drosophila, and it seems to be quite host specific. One of the bigger questions we have in studying lactobacilli and generous like Plantibacillus plantarum is they're kind of everywhere and they don't really have a favored host, but here this kind of points to that they can have favored environments and favorite hosts, and in this case Drosophila. So we've been exploring this with our own lactobacilli, and I think it's going to be quite an important story and one that we continue to follow in the field and as the story evolves.
Do you think that every lactobacillus, presumably with plantarum in this case, has access to a kind of a pan-genome of factors that they can go to the library and get something to colonize Drosophila, or go back to the library and borrow a gene that would allow them to colonize some other animal?
This is the question. And when we start to grow them in the laboratory, and many, you know, this was like 50 some passages, right? So it's not two generations, but it's a modest number of generations. And what we might be losing in our understanding of the ecological adaptations of these microbes to their natural environment. So
that was the worry, that, you know, the probiotics that we consume have probably been grown in glass test tubes in labs and then in stainless steel fermenters for many, many, many generations. And then we put them back into the gut and say, okay, do what you used to do, you know, or what your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents used to do in the gut. It's a difficult thing to manage.
So this coming year at the annual meeting, we are planning a discussion group on what is a strain. I know, Colin, this is something that you've written about in ISAP blogs. And so that is a kind of, I don't know, Pandora's box, maybe? We're about to open.
Yeah, I think it is. Gabrielle, what was your highlight?
I've been following for many years the issue of how to restore the microbiome in children that are born by C-section. We know that bifidobacteria in the first year of life are really relevant. And if the baby is born by C-section, bifidobacteria colonization will delay. And I think we all know the work of Maria Gloria Dominguez Bello in this topic, vaginal seeding. And then I would like to have the opinion of Sarah, because she's our expert on vaginal microbiome. But this year I saw, it's not yet a paper. It was a work that was presented in a congress. We can say it was a small work, 16 mothers. And it was led by Willem de Vos from the University of Helsinki. And what they did, they put 30 milligrams of mother feces, mother poop, in breast milk. And they gave that to children. And one can be very, very impressed. We all know about fecal microbiome transplantation for Clostridium difficile. And we are all thinking which will be the next microbiome transplantation. And they made this proof of concept because if the baby is born by vaginal delivery, it will get some micro from the anus of the mother. But putting 30 milligrams of feces can be very challenging and can be very... I was really surprised, but they achieved some correction in the microbiome. So I think that blown my mind. I'll say maybe in 10 years, that will be a routine in the hospital. I don't know. But in this case, I would like to hear Sarah's opinion on this topic.
Yeah, Gabriel, I think it's a very good example. And actually today, even at a microbiome meeting here in Antwerp, I saw Nicola Segata presenting the data again. Of course, I'm trained as a bioscience engineer and classical microbiologist. And for me, all this fecal microbiota transfer, although the effects are amazing, I always wonder, what about safety and robustness and how to control? So I never will see it happening. What you said in the hospitals within 10 years, I don't see it happening. And I'm also, maybe that's my European background, but I really worry about safety and certain issues. But of course, the effects are amazing. But I think as good microbiologists, we will be able to design proper mixtures and consortia that can have the same physiological effects and can then boost babies. But I like your, the fact that you picked it out, because I think how we build up our microbiome and from where all our gut microbiome members, but also in the other body size, where all these microbes come from, and how do we transfer microbes and what is transmission? We know so little about it. Birth is definitely an important factor, but I don't think we need to worry if we are born through C-section, because there's so many other transmission events that can just as well help you build up your microbiome. That's, I think, also an amazing area in the microbiome and biotic field that deserves more research, Colin.
Yeah, I think we can't kind of have it both ways. We can't say that we think the microbiome influences everything from brain function to cancer, aging, everything, but then we just casually change somebody's microbiome. You know, that's not... Those two things don't sit well with me. You know, the liver is really important for this function, that function, but let's change your liver metabolism. You know, you'd hesitate very, you know, the old adage of first do no harm. Like, until we understand the microbiome a lot better. I mean, if someone's dying of C. diff infection, then of course there are risks you can take in order to redress that and help the person survive. But the idea of just administering poop bar to see what happens is what kind of... Yeah, it gives me a bit of an itch too, but maybe that's my European background as well. That kind of leads us into the next question I want to bring up about regulators and regulatory progress. Are we making progress in terms of the regulatory, you know, stage on which we work? You know, people are doing amazing things in labs, the kind of bioengineering that you're doing, Sarah, and others, and the kind of fecal microbiota transplants that, yeah, giants in the field like Willem are doing and others. How is the regulatory environment? Is it changing? Is it more receptive to the kind of work that biotics researchers are doing? Maria, do you have an opinion on that?
Oh, Colin. Yeah. Well, in the US, it's been a tough year. So I actually, you know, we could just depart from your question for a moment and maybe return to some initiatives in Canada and Europe, which I think are really impactful. But this year's been a really tough year for science in the US. We're facing billions and billions of dollars of cuts just this year alone from NIH, NSF, and that's not just affected us in university, but also federal researchers at the CDC, FDA, EPA, USDA, with their jobs being cut or not being able to work for months at a time. So I don't see much happening at this year in the regulatory area, except we're looking at changes in vaccine guidance. So yeah, it's been a really tough time. It's going to get worse probably next year. Looking at budgets at the federal level, so I'm optimistic. You know, we can get through this, and you know, the U.S. has taken a very kind of a different approach with regulation and what we can claim on labels, and we'll see how that develops. But on the other end, we have EFSA and what happens in Europe, which is kind of swinging the pendulum, I think, in kind of to the other extreme, from more a loose framework here to more extreme at the other in Europe.
Sarah, what's your opinion? I mean, as a European scientist, do you see the regulatory framework changing, becoming more receptive to the idea of biotics and health claims, and are not?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword in a way. Or so at the one hand, I think, yeah, it's a pity that there's still no, except for the yogurt bacteria, no probiotics that have an approved health claim in Europe. So, and it's also a bit unclear which countries allow the use of probiotic and which countries don't. Like I think in Belgium, it's still banned to really use the term probiotic on your packaging, while in Italy and Spain, it is allowed. And also the use of health claims are really banned. But I also do see that packaging is changing. On the other hand, what I do see that regulatory authorities, that they are aware of the microbiome and probiotics. And so that's good. But on the other hand, it also means that they will make regulation sometimes more strict for the microbiome. And I'm a bit worried for the new regulation, which is called in Europe the SOHO regulation. So it's for substances of human origin, because it's adopted since, I think, last year, but it will really be fully into force in 2027. And they have included microbiome-based therapies such as fecal microbiota transplantation and even breast milk and live biotherapeutic products from isolates from the human microbiome, as they are part of this regulation. And it means, of course, that certain aspects will become more strict. You will have stricter rules on traceability. Not every lab will be allowed to isolate LBP candidates, because all will be have additional controls. A bit in the same way as they're already having regulation in place for the use of tissues and cells, the same rules will apply for the microbiome. And you can, of course, for me, it as a microbiologist, it feels a bit strange, because we just had the discussion on where does your microbiome come from? What is the transmission between microbes? So I don't think you own your bacteria, because they can come from everywhere, but the European regulation will consider them as substances of human origin. And I think it can hamper innovation in the future.
Yeah, I think it is a kind of a scary thought for scientists, at least, maybe not for members of the public. Maybe members of the public would think this is totally fine, that if something is extracted from your microbiome and goes on to, you know, become a therapy and make money, let's be honest, that you should be entitled to some kind of reach through on that. But equally, of course, you know, a tissue obviously came from someone. A micro can be isolated from a sewage treatment plant or from the soil, or from, you know, even gut microbes can be isolated from outside the body. So it is a difficult area, I think. Is there anything in South America specifically, Gabrielle, or do you follow more the US and the European regulatory frameworks?
I will jump to the North, and then I will come back to South America. 2 weeks ago, I was invited to a meeting in Toronto organized by the Western University, the University of Alberta, and University of Calgary. And they called it the Canadian Fermented Foods Initiative. What they are trying to do, they are trying to put a section in the Food Guide of Canada. The Food Guide of Canada is constantly being revised and updated. And they want to put a section on fermented foods to tell the population you should eat fermented food for this, for this, for this. And what I found very interesting is, first, I forgot, ISAP was very impactful for that meeting. Mary Ellen Sanders, Gregor Reid, Bud Hopkins were invited to the meeting, and Hannah Holscher and me. Maybe 10% of the meeting were ISAP people, so I think ISAP had a lot of contribute to this movement. And they invited two regulators from Health Canada. It's not usual that regulators sit and listen, and in this case, they were very, very, very nice people, very open to listen. They heard the arguments. I don't know how this will move forward, but I think if a day we open a food guide and we see a section for fermented foods, I think that will be a very big contribution. Then the challenge is, okay, what can you say? Can you advise to eat fermented foods that may have some alcohol to pregnant women, to children? I think that's an area that we have to discuss. And when I heard about that initiative, I start something like that in Argentina. I asked some people that are relevant in Argentina for fermented food, but I also have some access to a person that is connected to our food guide. And our food guide, they start a revision process next year. So we will try to produce one or two pages document and to offer them to say, okay, do you think this is okay? Do you dare to put this in the food guide? I think that can be very relevant, and I will use the concept of live dietary microbe that you and Maria very nicely developed together with some people. Seeing that concept is very powerful to say, okay, people, your diet should not be sterile. You should get some daily portion of live microbes. So I'm hopeful that in some years, the food guys will have a special section for fermented food. And I think that will be a great achievement that in part was sourced from ISAP.
We've been spending a lot of time talking about probiotics and microbes, but a really important component of ISAP would be prebiotics, and to extend that a little bit further, dietary fibers. And one thing that I picked up on in conversations with my friends in Europe is this ultra-processed food situation and labeling. And you know, when you add in a dietary fiber or a prebiotic, how would that be viewed? And so this is something I think I'm watching in the U.S. as well, just to see how this concept is picked up here, because that, you know, it's kind of a slippery slope when we talk about processed foods and within the nutrition community. I know there's a lot of debate, and see how that reflects back on regulators. So that's why I wanted to add to the regulatory piece. This is really important.
Yeah, I think there is some kind of at least an understanding in nutritional science that you can't just add a good ingredient to an inherently unhealthy food and then call it healthy. But if people are going to put fiber into a, you know, ultra processed food, can they then say, oh, good for your microbiome? I suspect that, hope not, and I suspect not, but let's see.
That I agree with. But yeah, what happens when you add a purified compound to food generally? Does that make it suddenly somehow ultra processed? And what is that definition?
Exactly. Okay. So now, each of the three of you, a story coming out of your own lab, some research you're involved in that really excites you going into 2026. Who's going to lead off on this one? Sarah, come on. Let me hear something from you.
Yeah, maybe I can start on the something we haven't discussed today yet is our work on the vaginal microbiome, because it's a part of the we most of the time talk about the gut microbiome and indeed the impact of diet and how we control it. But as a woman, the vaginal microbiome is at least I think as important as the gut microbiome. It's also the source of the first microbes, and I'm enthusiastic that we for the vaginal microbiome, we, because it's maybe a newer field, but we also managed to involve a lot of researchers from across the world, also a lot of maybe research from low and middle income countries that are also joining like a kind of sisterhood to jointly sample the microbiome, raise awareness, discuss topics, and also are really also starting sampling campaigns so that they can isolate bacteria that have the potential to be developed as future probiotics. And probably they don't have all this soil regulation as we in Europe. So, but I think it's important that we have also locally source microbes, maybe not the right word, but at least I think we were also discussing about adaptation of microbes. I think it's very important that probiotics and LBPs are also adapted to the local environment, local dietary habits, local genetics, and so on. And it's also very inspirational to see. And then also in that field, we are also focusing more and more on metabolites. And for example, one serendipity finding from my own lab where I'm really enthusiastic about is the serendipitous finding that we find that vaginal bacteria and lactobacilli, they also produce B vitamins. And I always thought that vitamin production by bacteria is important for the gut, but I would never have thought that it could have a function in the vagina. And this is also makes us think, okay, maybe even vaginal bacteria, they're not only there to protect against infections, but maybe they also have a systemic communication role and they can have more systemic impact. And that makes you think we are indeed often more microbial than we always thought. So that's opens up for our, at least for our own research, a lot of new inspirational ideas for future research.
Yeah, and I think the work you're doing on the vaginal microbiome is absolutely inspiring. And I'd encourage everybody to go and look at the ESALA website and you know, scientists in other countries, you know, get involved, join in. It's a stunning example of work coming out of your lab, but extending across the world. And I think it is an incredibly exciting area. Gabrielle, what about you? What's happening in your lab right now and what are you excited about?
Yeah, 2 points very quickly. One connected to what Sarah said. She initiated an amazing project, the ESALA project, and they started some sisterhoods in Spain, in Peru, and in Argentina. And we are trying to be on from Argentina. In our case, it's called Cecilia, for Cecilia Grierson, the first medical doctor. And for next year, we hope that we are able to make the survey, and then we will have a new PhD student to start isolated and doing some local microbiome study. That we have no vaginal microbiome study in Argentina. It will be the very, very first. And the other thing is I feel quite involved in the postbiotic thing, advocating for postbiotic. And this year we proposed a perspective paper on quantification. And okay, it's the moment to start quantifying postbiotics. So we are doing some quantitative PCR or cytometry. And the issue is when you put dead microbes in a matrix that has already the microbes. So how to differentiate that? And if it is a fermented matrix, the level of microbes will be as high as the one you're putting. So that's a challenge. And I hope we can give some solution for next year.
Yeah, I think, again, I complimented Sarah on her the ESALA project. But I think for you on the postbiotic field, I think it's an area where you really have shown a lot of leadership and the community owes you a vote of thanks, I think, for that. You've really pushed that as a scientific concept to try and really crystallize what is a postbiotic and how can we measure them and how can we follow them and tremendous work. So congratulations on that. Maria, from your own lab and collaborators?
Yeah. What I want to highlight is that I'm really excited about fermented foods. I've been always a little excited about them, but now I'm really excited. I mentioned earlier this compound ILA, which was shown to be modulatory and the gut-brain axis and maybe reduce their depression or affect how her brain works. It's enriched in sauerkraut. Published a small paper earlier this year on sauerkraut and the kind of metabolites that are enriched during fermentation, and kind of predicted, like, these are the same kind of microbes that we find in our probiotics, or making ILA and many other beneficial compounds. And we showed these compounds are able to protect the intestinal barrier and cell culture. And now we've moved this to a human study. We're about to start recruiting in a study in kimchi intake in the U.S. and to be the first of its kind. I'm excited to collaborate with Francine Steiberg in nutrition department, who is an expert in human studies. So I'm excited to launch into that area. So much of my work has been focused on a preclinical or culture work, and now I'm ready to move to human studies. And I think this is a bigger framing in the U.S. right now, is fermented foods are hot.
And do you think fermented foods are beneficial in terms of providing micronutrients and vitamins and things that the bugs make? Or do you think there's also a role for, like, host interactions, the actual bacteria in the fermented foods interacting with the host through the enteric mucosal system or whatever? Do you think it's a bit of both or mainly one or the other?
both and. And, you know, it's going to be food dependent, right? If you have a sourdough bread as opposed to a yogurt, you are getting fundamentally, you're getting live microbes with the yogurt, won it with the bread, but you are getting the metabolites like acetate that's enriched during the fermentation. These are complex matrices. So it's going to be a bit of both.
Yeah. I always find it perplexing that people, medics in particular, clinicians, accept completely that ingesting 100 listeria can kill you, but 10 to the 9 lactobacilli, how could they possibly give you a health benefit? It's such a strange kind of inversion, you know, that we understand that some bacteria can have a massive physiological impact on the host. We don't accept that can ever be positive or beneficial. But I think the kind of work ISAP has done and is doing, yeah, is convincing people and clinicians as well that microbes and microbial metabolites play a big role in human health.
Yeah. And I think we might be coming at that from the angle of fermented foods. Mm-hmm. As clinicians are saying, or pharmacists are saying, have some yogurt with you when you take antibiotics, for example. So there is this perception. And Gabrielle and I are working on a paper right now to talk not so much about the microbes, but the metabolites in fermented foods and in postbiotics and what we understand, just ingesting the metabolites or compounds like peptidoglycan. If I can add one more thing, and that is what I see coming ahead, is our consensus panel, our ISAP consensus panel on gut health manuscript is now has been accepted and we're working on it. So in 2026, we're going to be talking a lot more about gut health.
Well, we can really look forward to that. And guys, thank you to the three of you, Gabrielle, Sarah, Maria.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Extraordinary work you're doing with ISAP and ISAP is doing, and thank you for that. And thus we end our 2025 series of podcasts on this note. So thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.